Good evening. Hi. I'm David Madden of the Department of Sociology here at the LSE, and I just want to welcome everyone to this event and, by way of introduction, give a bit of background about why we're holding this particular discussion at this particular moment. First, I do want to start by thanking a few people who helped make this event possible: the Department of Sociology at LSE and the Sussex Center for Cultural Studies for their support. We want to thank Emma Glassy for working tirelessly to help us organize this event. All the speakers earlier today for being incredibly informative and incisive. Dan Jones for the excellent exhibition in the atrium of the NAB. If you haven't seen it, you should go over and take a look. Of course, Professor Anoop Nayak for being the keynote speaker tonight. And I also want to thank the other organizers of this event, Suzanne Hall, and especially Naj Rashid, who really has been central to this event. This has been her project from the beginning. And she created a truly, I think, unique and important public event. And we had a symposium earlier that was really just excellent. So thank you to all of them, and thank you to all of you for coming. This lecture tonight is the keynote lecture of a broader program that's called Race, Violence, and the City, Remembering Altab Ali, Interrogating the Present. So who was Altab Ali? Why should Altab Ali be remembered? And why are we holding this event now? This lecture and symposium are timed to commemorate a brave and in many ways heroic response to a tragedy that occurred 40 years ago this year. The tragedy took place on the evening of the 4th of May, 1978. Altab Ali, a 25-year-old garment worker who had been born in Bangladesh and migrated to London when he was a teenager, had left a grocery store in Brick Lane and was walking home along Adler Street in Whitechapel, leaving the shops to do some cooking when he was stabbed to death by three teenagers. The murder was completely unprovoked. In response to police questioning, one of the killers, a 16-year-old, gave the motive as no reason at all. But during their trial, Ali's killers admitted to routinely engaging in racist aggression. And indeed, Altab Ali's murder took place in an atmosphere of ubiquitous racist violence. Only a fortnight before Altab Ali was killed, Kenneth Singh, a 10-year-old, was murdered in Canning Town. And Ali's killing was one of eight racist murders in 1978 alone. According to Blood on the Streets, the September 1978 report on racist attacks in the East End, published by the Bethnal Green and Stepney Trades Council, quote, "The barrage of harassment, insult, and intimidation, week in, week out, fundamentally determines how the immigrant community here lives and works, how the host community and the authorities are viewed, and how the Bengali people in particular think and act," close quote. I think that we are holding this event because we need to understand and remember this history, but we also want to commemorate the heroic response, which was that the Bengali community and others in the East End responded to Ali's killing with a massive wave of collective violence and anti-racist mobilization. 10 days after the murder, a huge march was organized where somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 people marched from Whitechapel to Parliament, around Hyde Park Corner, and back to the East End. This was the first of many actions that were intent on fighting back against the agents and structures of racialized violence and inequality. This movement brought together diverse communities from working class East London, not only Bengali workers and youth, but also militant trade unionists, aging Jewish radicals with their own searing memories of fascist violence in London and abroad, and many others. Rajan Uddin Jalal, a longtime activist and one of the founders of the Bangladeshi youth movement, told the sociologist Claire Alexander in 2011, quote, "I think the younger generation realized that they had to stay in this country and decided to fight back. And I think there was a phase in the mid-70s when the Bengali community came of age. These murders created the impetus for going public with the resistance," close quote. So 40 years on, it's this public resistance that is the legacy of the movement that arose in response to Altab Ali's death. T- Today, when British cities are once again seeing rising levels of racist and anti-migrant violence, when the state is developing new forms of racialized exclusion, and when, consequently, we're seeing new forms of anti-racist mobilization, it is obvious that the questions raised by this history are still live issues. In fact, it needs no explanation for why this history is relevant to today. Tonight, to teach us about all of these issues and many more, we have Professor Anoop Nayak, who is professor in social and cultural geography and head of department at Newcastle University. Anoop has published widely in the sociology of race and ethnic studies, youth culture, social class, and gender and masculinities. He's the author of Race, Place, and Globalization, Youth Cultures in a Changing World, as well as co-author with Mary Jane Cahilly of Gender, Youth, and Culture, Global Masculinities and Femininities, as well as co-author with Alex Jeffrey of Geographical Thought. He's the lead researcher on a project on young people, diversity, and belonging in a post-Brexit age, which I'm sure we'll hear about tonight. So we're honored to have Anoop here to speak with us, and I'm going to turn the floor over to him. So thank you.
Right, well, thanks very much for the invite. In particular, I'd like to thank Naz, David, Susie, and Emma for all the hard work behind the scenes. That often goes unrecognized, so thanks to you all. Fantastic. And I learned a lot today coming along this afternoon about Al-Tabali and particularly some of the archival stuff. And it made me kind of want to reposition some of this paper as well to sort of pull out more strongly some of the connections that I'm trying to make. And the title of this talk, White Lines, Young People, Conviviality and Conflict in Peripheral Places, touches upon many of the themes that are central to this conference that's gone on today. So here, ideas about Brexit, ideas about living in a toxic environment around race are critical for thinking through these issues. So some of what I want to do today is present some fairly tentative work, I might say. It's work that is ongoing, part of a project that David mentioned, in order to try to think through what these issues are, and in particular how they're played out in very different landscapes. Close this one.
Sorry, I think maybe it's just minimize it and
yeah,
there we go.
There we go.
Great.
Cool.
Slideshow play there.
There we Perfect. Go. Great. Okay, thanks. Okay, so I've been working on this project, which I've been leading with some colleagues at Newcastle University, and we've been going to different places across Britain. And mainly we're looking at young people's everyday lives and thinking about forms of belonging, forms of community, but also forms of social division. So at the moment, we've been to Sunderland and also Dundee, and we've got a site in Wales that we're going to follow up on as well. And I want to give special mention to the postdoc researcher, Robin Finlay, who's done quite a lot of the interviews along with myself on this project. And the two of us probably have done most of the work in Sunderland. Susie will know Robin, of course, as well from a previous project. Now, one of the things that struck me is if I was to kind of look at the kind of contemporary work on race and ethnicity, I'd characterize it as having undergone a type of convivial turn. So a lot of the kind of contemporary work, for example, has used Gilroy's ideas as a type of springboard to think about multiculturalism and how we learn to live with difference. And these kind of accounts have been, I think, quite interesting in if we think about what they were trying to do. And as I would see it, I think part of the envisioning of that cultural, of that convivial turn, was to try to move away from accounts that were purely about securitization, community cohesion and some of the more negative aspects that we link up to notions of ethnicity and difference. So Gilroy's idea of multiculturalism, I should say, he makes that very distinct from state multiculturalism. Here he talks about conviviality, as many of you will know, as being about the kind of everyday rubbing along together, has been quite useful. And it's connected with various debates around superdiversity, intersectional forms of difference, and examples of this include various work that are broadly about living multiculture and what Wise and Velimutham have called everyday multiculturalism. Now, while I think that work is quite valuable, stepping back from it, I think there are also some limitations. For example, a lot of the work geographically has been located in highly particular places. So if we look at the work that's taken place, it's usually in very super diverse neighborhoods, often in large multicultural cities. So this includes work in London, Leicester, Bradford, Birmingham, and so on. So a lot of interesting work in these large multi-ethnic cities that have come up with concepts and ideas about race and ethnicity and everyday multiculture. But they're located, I would argue, in very specific places. So how does this sit with what we now know about Brexit? Okay, so this mode of conviviality, which seemed very melodious, seemed very, very, you know, very nice, people rubbing along together, etc. You know, it's almost as if the needle on the record has been scratched, okay? Suddenly that tune of conviviality gets stuck. So what I'm calling for, really, is a need for race and ethnic scholars to pay attention to the silences and some of the issues around power that I believe were always there and present anyway. Brexit, I think, has just been a sort of, has just exposed, really, what was perhaps going on elsewhere, and even in some of the places that these studies have occurred in. So in no way do I want to kind of, you know, rule out that work, but I think it's important to have a sort of more sobering set of accounts. And I want to begin by really noting how Brexit itself was a deeply racialized event, or at least the referendum was. So Rita mentioned the kind of go-home vans that were there and being, you know, moved around London. And I find that really interesting in terms of the kind of discussions around everyday bordering that was mentioned. The ideas of these kind of movable things that create certain race effects. They make some people feel deeply unwelcome. And I think, you know, I would feel unwelcome even though I'm, you know, was born here. So the effects of those kind of things, I think, do create a very particular atmosphere. So those kinds of events, and if we think how Brexit, if you like, has been a sort of lightning rod for a lot of anxieties, it very rapidly happened that UK independence became much more about race and migration than economic relations and other social factors, monetary factors, and so on. So that happened actually quite quickly. And obviously part of that was UKIP rhetoric, the rhetoric by Farage in that infamous poster down there that Britain was at breaking point. That became a sort of very sort of effective kind of statement that we were at breaking point and somehow would fall apart with any more, you know, immigration carried on. It was kind of critical, I think, to that rhetoric. And it soon became rapidly taken up by right-wing parties and even came to consolidate a sort of centre ground where the discussion then became about the problem of getting your child into schools or national health services and so on. And I think of my own father who came here and worked in the National Health Service. So there was very little about those people actually being involved in that end of it, in delivering service, but much more about us taking up space within those services. So something very particular was happening here. Perhaps, though, the nadir off the EU referendum, though, was right on the run-up to it, was the murder of Labour MP Joe Cox. So here, some very strong parallels with the political moment of that was spoken about regarding Al Tabali and how that was prior to an election. So when Joe Cox was killed, she worked in a multicultural constituency and was known for making connections and friendships in that community. The killer shouted, "Britain first." So a sense that she had favoured particular groups. So this really kind of deeply racialises the EU referendum. So all of this was going on in the run-up to it. And then if we think afterwards, in the immediate aftermath, the Home Office reported a rise in hate crime. So some of the figures I've put up there, Home Office reporting a 41% rise in hate crime afterwards. National Police also say 58% rise in hate crime. And this was religious and racist hate crime, both to new migrants, ethnic minorities, as well as some faith groups and some white migrants as well. So it was kind of a complex set of relations that had bubbled over, and it was almost as if something that was simmering around race and ethnicity had reached boiling point. So I thought it was important to kind of provide that kind of atmospheric context here. But I want to argue that in light of that, a new geography of race and ethnicity is required if we are to move away from some of the focal points of conviviality and superdiversity research. And perhaps that means reckoning with some of the uncomfortable truths of Brexit and going into some of the more unfashionable post-industrial peripheries. So these are often places that have voted very strongly to leave the EU. And I'm intrigued in a way how those kind of emotions and those discourses carry this effective weight. Paul Gilroy, of course, has spoken about post-colonial melancholia, but the way in which that can be harnessed and bleed into violence, I think, is particularly chilling. So if you look back at the geography of voting patterns when it came to the EU referendum, the picture was fairly stark. The Midlands voting to leave, and along with North East England and also Wales. Scotland, there was heavy support to remain, as there was also in London and particularly inner city London. So interesting sort of geography here. And I've done similar things around looking at kind of youth votes and other things. And you get more complex pictures as well, which I think are also really, really interesting in terms of telling us about some of the reasons for the vote. But I'm going to put a focus upon one of the kind of places where we've been doing a lot of work, which is the city of Sunderland. Now, broadly speaking, Sunderland had an industrial history. So it was associated with shipbuilding, with coal mining, and industrial glassmaking of a very large kind. Today, many of these industries are shrunk back. They barely exist. And there's a heavy quotidian of people that work now in the public sector, and it's got also higher than average levels of unemployment. I should also say that Sunderland is an unusual place in terms of how it's grown up. So it doesn't have, although it has a city centre, it's not a sort of huge city centre for the size of the population. And part of this is because it's... I'm just going to get the water. Part of this is because it's grown up as almost like a series of small villages that would have been like pit villages or areas that would have grown up around the shipbuilding industry, manufacturing trades and so on. So you've almost got a patchwork of kind of little villages, each with their own sort of distinctive cultures. So there is something interesting and insular about the geography of the place. Nevertheless, it is a large city with over 275,000 people, and it's a mainly white city. So it's 95% white, so it's one of the whitest places in the country. And its largest migrant group is South Asian population and a Bangladeshi population, but that's still less than 1%. So you might wonder, why should race be such an issue in a place that's so predominantly white? Why should the vote to leave, which was 61%, be so strenuous? The area, for example, the largest employer also in Sunderland is the Nissan car plant, which has been there for a number of years, and that foreign direct investment is kind of critical to the economy there. So there's some uncalibrated and complex, probably psychosocial reasons why people would vote to leave. And going into these places, it was very clear that a sense of powerlessness was important, unemployment, a sense of feeling besieged, and also it didn't help that the Northeast has been ritualistically voting for Labour, and when David Cameron went round asking people to remain, this went down, you know, really badly in the Northeast. So there was also that element of a protest vote as well. So lots of complex things going on. Now, there's also been a lot of far-right activity in Sunderland, because it's a mainly white area. And in some of the local elections, far-right candidates have stood in each of the 25 wards. Now, it's not to say they've got in, but nevertheless, it's seen as a place where if you're a far-right organisation, you might think you'd get that type of support. Now, our work has been based in two wards, in Southwick, which is a predominantly white working class ward, and in Hendon, which is also white working class, but has also pockets of Bangladeshi populations. So we've been looking and walking around these two areas. Now, I can't say more about our methods, maybe later on, but I'd loosely describe them almost as kind of ethnographic walks and talks. So we've been walking around the areas, and that's been actually really interesting, because I think there's something about the act of walking which gets, you know, which familiarises you with a place in a different way. And we've also been doing some walking interviews, which have also been really insightful in showing us, with young people, showing us the kind of microgeographies of particular places. And I'll say and show more about that. But as Les Backer said, one of the things about ethnography is the act, he says in his book, The Art of Listening, it's about listening with the eye. And I think kind of walking around makes you very aware of different embodied sensations, walking up stairways, going down places, and also feeling the tonality of different neighbourhoods. So as I said, it was almost like there was a series of villages, local communities that had grown from them, and you could feel the atmosphere change as you move through these different places. Now, what I want to do today is speak about one key theme that sort of appeared in the work, and I broadly call this a theme around conviviality and conflict. So this is to add some kind of more structural relations of power to those kind of looser ideas of conviviality. I should say the two terms are not meant to sit there as a binary, but hopefully what I'll try to do is show how they can be interwoven together, how conviviality can cohere at particular moments, fall apart on others, and how conflict may also be summoned to life in live events. So in order to distill conviviality and conflict and how one bleeds into the other, I'm going to choose three examples. I'm going to look at attitudes towards the neighbourhood and some place attachments and how also that could then lead to turf wars. I'm going to look at young people gathering in particular spaces, but then finding those spaces become highly regulated, and also look at how race intervenes in in community relations and becomes a sort of dividing point that at least momentarily feels very fixed and creates these types of division. Okay, so thinking about this first one then, surprisingly, while Sunderland has a very negative representation as an old, decaying post-industrial place from outsiders, we found that many young people spoke very positively about it and had place attachments to the area in which they lived. So these are just a couple of examples. One young man said, "I couldn't wait to move back to Sunderland, me." And he'd been posted away in the army. He says, "I lived in Thorny Island, down south, next to Portsmouth." So we say, "Well, what's so special about Sunderland?" And he said, "I just love it. I don't know. I really enjoy living here. I think it's because I lived away. I love it. It makes you appreciate home a lot more, especially all your mates and family. So moving back, I'm buzzing." A girl said, "Look, it's probably because it's where I grew up. It's what I know." Another young man said, "Look, it's like where all my mates are, so I really enjoy myself here. That's probably the reason." And this idea of community kept coming forward. "I just see myself staying in Sunderland," said another young man. And here, he actually touched upon some important class dynamics. He'd gone to some other places and he said, "I like it because I don't have to change who I am. Like the way I talk, I can just talk with slang and everybody will understand me." So they were very aware of the stigma of being from the north and particularly of being from Sunderland and carrying a very specific accent. So another young man also, you know, very kind of erudite way, pointed out what might be thought of as a kind of, you know, popular socialism that existed. And he says, "Well, it's a fact that the way I see it, people make Sunderland. It's not what we've got in the city. It's just the people." And someone and his friend says, "Yeah, the community, you know, we have like pride for the area." And they go on, "It's nice to have a close community. You feel like if you've got an issue, you can turn to your neighbour. And that neighbour will help you. It's not like, oh no, it won't help you because your family's this and that. If you want to borrow money, they don't ask you how much. They just say yes. It's sort of like, we're proud of our area." And he concludes by saying, which I found really interesting, he says, "Look, it's your area, so don't shit on your own doorstep." And here he meant that lots of people were running down Sunderland. And there's a lot of figures and, you know, surveys that are done which have described it as one of the worst places to live. But you had young people actually showing a lot of pride of place and making these place attachments and saying, "Look, we shouldn't run down, you know, the very good things that are going on here." So in those broad sort of sketchy terms, there were strong forms of conviviality that the young people were pointing towards. And interesting that they were so class-laden as well. However, what we did find was that part of that, those forms of conviviality could also lead to forms of parochialism. So on one of the walk-arounds, some of the young men pointed to the particular architecture of places and how that had created forms of division. So this young man on the walk, he said, "Look, you can feel between the areas. It's very territorial. Even the way the houses are laid out, they've literally got their backs to each other." And he took us down this street and he pointed out how the road became a dividing place between two, it was a dividing place between two areas. So you had Southwick on one side and Marley Potts, a different neighbourhood, on the other. And he said that if you cross over this road and go into this other neighbourhood, you're immediately a stranger and, you know, you could get beaten up. So this tension, he was saying, was about the kind of the way that the architecture had structured particular relations that then people are invested in. So it actually says, this road, it's like literally crossing the border. And another young man pointed to these microgeographies as well, saying, people fight because of where they live. You know, Hendon, if you walk out of Smethwick and go to Hendon, which is got some of the multicultural areas, he goes, you're going to get your head kicked in. And he also spoke about kind of postcodes, which I know are more familiar in London, as kind of one of the ways in which territoriality was taking place. So in a sense, these postcode practices are, of course, both signifiers of place attachment, but also markers of potential conflict. It was clear that young people had a highly refined knowledge of place, and had they not taken us on these walks, we wouldn't have been aware of the nuances and subtleties of the divisions and markers of conflict that existed. So, you know, so their knowledge of these places was also very, very acute, very nuanced and sophisticated. So as they took us around these places, they often took us through old industrial haunts. So on some of these walks, they took us down to the river and we encountered various forms of graffiti. And the river is basically in an area of Southwick where the young people like to hang out. And many continually make use of these kind of old de-industrial spaces. And this kind of graffiti there, STS is the best. This was like Southwick top squad. And then this other one, WTS are tossers. This was Witherwax top squad. So there was this kind of local rivalry that was going on. And it was sometimes ratcheted up when you'd hear the, you know, and it was mainly young men sort of chanting, you know, STS, we're the best, and this kind of thing. So this kind of investment in locality could then sort of take on this more divisory sort of position. But what I suppose is interesting is the way in which young people use these old post-industrial spaces and re-enliven them. But also graffiti, I think, becomes a mobile means of turning the arbitrary nature of space into territory, so laying claim to those spaces. And if you haven't got very much, that becomes central to who you are. So on these walk-alongs then, young people continually drew our attention to these kind of, you know, like I said, these kind of microgeographies that meant a lot to them. Okay, so places weren't just being seen by us, but were being rethought about in a very kind of critical way by the young people. So thinking about these de-industrial spaces, at the top there you have a picture of Fulwell Quarry. It's now been grassed over, and a lot of young people like to go and ride bikes there, BMXs, and also use mini motorbikes and so on. And below, this was a real favourite hangout for a time among with young people, and this is actually a place that's got old limestone quarries, and it's got these tunnels, like old limestone tunnels, and young people would go and sort of hang out there, play music, drink there, and you know, basically socialise. So the kind of infrastructure of conviviality was being taken up in these places. However, there was also heavy forms of regulation that seemed to change that. So here the young men explained to us how new dispersal orders meant that that form of camaraderie and friendship was now dissipating. So he told us about the dispersal orders that were being attributed. And they said, the dispersal orders, it's essentially, if a group of more than two people, if you're in a group of more than two people, you're classed as a gang. We heard quite a lot about gangs before. So more than two people, you know, that allows the police to disperse you. So, you know, he goes on, and therefore they have to separate. So the police will come up to you and say, right, you two go that way, you two go that way, and you two head off in that direction. They'll separate us. And it's basically, he said, because they think more than two people were going to cause trouble, you know, i.e. we're a gang. And his friend chipped in, you know, it's kind of kill the area. Normally there'd be loads of people around here, and he was talking about the space at the bottom with the limestone tunnels. He said, yeah, normally there'd be loads of people around here. You know, there'd be a couple sat there having, there were just a couple sat having a drink. Often there'd be music and other things. That was all, that had all gone. And he says, you know, look, we don't have a lot. And basically, if you get together with your mates, it's now classed as antisocial. So what was interesting to me was the ways that young people were animating and enlivening the dead industrial landscapes but at the same time were being highly regulated and policed around that. So they were constantly being broken up, and it was having quite a severe effect. So people stopped coming there. And it was almost like the only space, I think, was some of the tunnels where you could be out of sight. It's difficult to explain, but this is at the bottom of a river. So if you're walking along the top bit, which most people did, you wouldn't actually know that there was quite a lot of young people down there. But, you know, they were constantly having to sort of be vigilant. And, you know, what had been a very friendly, convivial space was now highly policed. So I want to turn now to my third and final example, really, about conviviality and conflict. And this is the way in which race intersects into these accounts very most vividly. And, you know, it was interesting to me because you've got a city that's 98% white, and yet race was constantly spoken about by the young people that we interviewed. And that didn't matter, you know, who they were, because often we didn't even ask those questions. They came up in conversations. So that was actually in itself quite interesting. And we did various focus groups with young Asian women, mainly Bangladeshi, and also young men that were white, and different cohorts of youth to get different opinions. But interesting that race cropped up so many times. So I should say that the picture at the top is actually a mosque, and which is, you know, has been developed by the Bangladeshi community as part of what's known as the Seven Streets, around which they live in one particular area. So one young woman said how she feels better in Hendon. She says, because there's more Bengali people here, more people my colour. So if anything does happen, I've got everyone around me. And someone else who lived in Eden Vale said, pointed to something actually that was referred to briefly in one of the earlier talks about the kind of institutional aspects of racism via policing. And this young woman talked about the English Defence League and said, look, the EDL came down and the police were promoting it. She saw that was a word she used. They were promoting this rally. She says, because I got a text saying, be safe, blah, 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 you know, don't go outside. And she was like, why do I have to? Why do I feel like and I thought she was going to say in my own country, and she sort of stopped herself and then went, I was born and bred in Sunderland. Why do I need to be like, I can't go into town because they, the EDL, are there? You shouldn't bring these EDL people down if they're unsafe to the public. Like, if the Muslim community feel unsafe, the police need to go and think, oh my God, we can't bring the EDL here because it's not safe for the Muslim community. And so she argued that they were actually promoting this by allowing this to demonstration to happen ritualistically, but then, you know, telling women and men to sort of go indoors. And I've been to quite a few of the anti-racist demonstrations, and the Muslim communities are constantly told to close their shops during the times that happens, and so on. So it feels like even though they are the part of the community, they immediately become sort of the ones that are asked to sort of close down for the night or for the day, you know. So it does seem to be this kind of complete imbalance and a lack of understanding. So one of the ways in which this perhaps has come to a head was with a particular issue that I'm going to touch upon. Now, I don't know how well that's come out there with the lights, but the graffiti as we were walking around, there was lots of these statements saying justice for Chelsea. And just to fill you in on this, this was a story that basically has come up very much in the local press, and broadly speaking, Chelsea Wright was a young 26-year-old woman who claimed she'd been drugged on a night out in Sunderland and had been raped on Peel Street, which is in the Hendon area, and that's Peel Street in the bottom right-hand corner. And she says that she woke up and there were six men from Iraq, Syria, Bahrain, who were arrested. And this became a highly racialized event. Now, it didn't start off like that, but the case was dropped, it was thrown out. Now, I don't want to sort of speculate on that, whether it was down to process, whether it was because the men were innocent or lack of evidence, etc. But what was interesting was Chelsea was known to some of the young people that we spoke to. She went to a college, and some of the young Asian people actually said, oh, yeah, it's terrible what's happened to her. You know, we're really quite shocked. But then when the event, resulted in, the alleged perpetrators being released, you know, that everything seems to come to a head. So this is right in the heart of the Bangladeshi area. And quite soon after, Tommy Robinson from the EDL set up a Justice for Chelsea website. And the EDL have been, setting up various police, various EDL marches, starting out on Peel Street and so on. And there's a lot of social media which has been kind of really fueling the Justice for Chelsea campaign. So what was something that locals in the area had got behind became racially divisive. So white lines were being drawn around who belonged and who didn't, even though Tommy Robinson and the English Defence League, they're not from Sunderland. So these white lines were continually cutting across these notions of belonging and any ideas of community and conviviality. What I think is also interesting is that Chelsea herself, in a kind of familiar colonial form, becomes the kind of embodiment of innocence and purity that's, the passive person that sort of the struggles happen around, somehow embodying nationhood and whiteness. So the picture that's posed there actually is very different. This is from the EDL website. It's very different to some of the pictures in the press. But the EDL have also, I should say, set up a crowdsourcing thing for, to give her and her family a holiday. So you can see how these discourses are being evoked here, to kind of do good for Chelsea, and the effects of that for those that are in the Bangladeshi community that were supportive and live, in this environment and constantly have to walk past these signs. And now, the kind of atmosphere has changed that they are somehow culpable for what's happened here, even though, they're entirely removed from it. So it's those kind of ideas that I think are particularly pertinent. And while conviviality might, open up for them for moments, it's very clear, as, Stuart Hall has argued, that there's kind of, race is a floating signifier. And I'm always interested, perhaps, in how that floating signifier comes to settle and get stuck in particular places and around particular people. Okay, so in this way, race, Sarah Ahmed records, has a kind of, she speaks about the stickiness of race. And I certainly felt going into these neighbourhoods that race had a viscosity. It seemed to stick to the place. Suddenly, this was the Bangladeshi area. This was the area where certain things happened. This was an area that was set apart from the rest of the community. So it was almost as if race was coming to adhere to bodies, objects, and things. And occasionally it could accumulate around particular events, and these were often unfolding live events, and then it could dissipate again. But it was constantly being circulated around these neighbourhoods. So, like I said, you would think it would be a non-issue in, an area that's 95% white, but it was constantly there being evoked, being played out, and so on. And Brexit, I think, is sort of the kind of veneer under which that's been happening. So in this, in one of our kind of focus groups with young unemployed white men, the kind of these issues of race were really, highly evident. So we didn't even ask about questions of ethnicity, but immediately they kind of very quickly went into it. We were asking about the place they lived in, you know, what they liked about it, what they didn't like, and straight away, you know, they went into stuff about that became highly racialized. So one young man said, you know, and they lived, and I should say, they live in South, you know, they live in Southwick, so this is a really white working class area, said, do you know that place? I can't remember its name. It's, because I can't say its name because it's racist. And he said, Thingy Town. And a couple of his friends say, Eden Vale. And he says, well, I cycled over there, and I got chased by loads of them, man. And then his friend jumps in, interjects, do you want to know the name of the place? And he says in a loud voice, by all means, here, this is no offence or out. It's called Pakiland. And they go on. It's just fenced off and everything. There's loads of them there. There's a Bengali centre down there too. And they say, look, not one white person goes down there. If a white person guns in, they get done in. And another one comes up. Eden Vale is where my mum lives. And they literally try and start on you just because you're walking past, just because your skin colour's white. So here there's a picture of a kind of cartography of race that's highly segregated around particular areas. But I'm going to sort of just say three brief points before I conclude this talk in kind of thinking through that vignette. And there's lots of other, you know, there's a lot that came from this group and from other groups that were deeply racialized. But I'm just going to focus here on just this kind of small vignette. And maybe a first point I want to make, which came up time and time again, was a continual reiteration of white victimhood and white grievance. So this was ritualistically brought up, that whites were the victim of certain things. And this, I think, has a kind of key role in some of the debates around Brexit. So this seemed to be taken on. So for the young people that we spoke with, being white, especially being working class or unemployed, meant you were, it was an that whiteness here was an identity under siege. Rather than recognising whiteness as a marker of privilege, the young men invariably saw it as, or, and saw themselves as downtrodden victims of socio-economic change. A second point I want to make is that while race is often, you know, was spoken very, very much in this moment, it often went unspoken in a lot of the interviews that we did. So even here, you know, there's a sense that, and you know, young men immediately went into this and then said, I can't say it because it's racist, and then come up with this thing, you know, this invented place, Thingy Town, and then someone does say how they associate with it. At the same time, these silences, there's loads of them, you know, who are these then? You know, and then, you know, the idea that somehow you've got this, you know, all Bangladeshi area. And then, you know, even though there's this contradiction when immediately another young man says that his mum lives there and she's white. So these kind of contradictions were continually peppering the narratives we got. Okay, but this sense of white grievance was kind of undergirding a lot of these narrative accounts. So I'll finish then with just a few observations. And these are initial observations because this is ongoing work. And that's, I suppose, firstly, that I think while, you know, I've said the work on conviviality has been helpful to a certain degree, I think we need to reckon with some of the political and uncomfortable truths of Brexit regarding race and immigration. So here, I'm not suggesting that Brexit created racism, but it exposed it and arguably has amplified it. Secondly, we need to hear much more from disenfranchised youth, and young people in particular were completely silenced around the Brexit debate. So when it came to like the Scottish independence vote, you know, there was a big discussion about, you know, lowering the age to people that were 16. You know, there was none of that in the UK. And we now know since then, 72% of young people would vote to remain. So that's a huge amount, you know. And, you know, you could argue that, if anything, you know, if you want to put an age barrier, then it should have perhaps been put up at a high level. You know, should you be voting if you're over 65? You know, so you know, especially as we know that older people are overrepresented in the polls. So that issue about young people being left out, I think, is really critical, and that's something we're hoping to address in this work. I've suggested that the research on superdiversity and everyday multiculturalism has at times operated with flat ontologies. It's ignored some of the topographies of power, social structures, and what Philomena Essed very early on spoke about everyday racism, the kind of ritualistic racism that happens every day and that we certainly encountered in Sunderland. So a much better understanding here of how how conviviality and conflict can work together, bleed into one another, recompose, etc., I think is what we're trying to move towards. And then a final point really is about the need for new geographies of race and ethnicity that go beyond the multicultural metropolis, that look at places like Rotherham that was mentioned today, or you know, Stoke, Peterborough, and so on, because these are the places which I think race and ethnic scholars need to go to and have tended to be largely omitted simply because they're not seen as places that have large minority populations. And I think that's also has a racializing effect on the type of research we do and where we do it. So I'll end on that point. Okay.
Thank you very much. This was a really interesting discussion about a lot of very important and contemporary issues that are floating through social scientific research, but also just the newspaper on a daily basis. So I think this is a really important discussion. We definitely want to have questions from the audience, but maybe we can start the discussion with by hearing a bit more from you about the better understandings of conviviality and conflict that you mentioned. I think this is quite interesting. So it'd be great to hear more. I mean, do you see the forms of conflict that you describe as in some ways the dark side of conviviality, or do you think that more or different forms of conviviality might be a means to reduce conflict or at least to somehow transform conflict in some sort of positive way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've purposely tried not to see that as a binary, and so I wanted to, you know, I actually wanted to show actively the forms of conviviality that were going on in these neighbourhoods that are often seen as conflict-ridden and so on. There was lots of kind of sharing of resources, lots of friendship groups coming together, but also these points where things could change according to particular events. So, you know, the Justice for Chelsea is probably a good example of a kind of community really getting behind something, and then these kind of white lines of power intersecting it and changing the meaning of it through social media and so on. So this is not in any way to kind of talk about these communities as being sort of, you know, reifying them in a nostalgic way, as having some socialist community to them that ignores conflict, or of seeing them as, like, you know, worse than, you know, London or Birmingham or anywhere else.
I think it's quite a good language to talk about the connections between race and racism and territory when you're discussing the sort of stickiness of race and how it sort of congeals in particular places and in particular times and connected to particular people. Did you ever see any examples of race becoming unsticky or fluid in sort of meaningful senses? I mean, if the sort of stickiness of race is variable, when did you see it becoming unstuck in some ways?
Yeah, it definitely seemed. Young people gave some accounts of schooling, and I've written a little bit about this in a 2017 paper published in Transactions for the Institute of British Geographers, where a Bangladeshi young woman spoke about how originally when she started going to school, she encountered a lot of hostility, but then got to know people and that dissipated. So she formed multicultural friendships in school. So schools were places where that could happen. And she then said when she got older, she had a really positive experience in school, and others also had that. But at the same time, we're very aware of going out to certain places in the city centre that where that could where that tonality could change again. So race was constantly, as a sticky sign, was this kind of floating signifier that, you know, became, you know, you could move through, you could be quite a mobile subject at one point, but it might adhere you to a place at another so that you couldn't go into those places. And certainly some of the young women, especially if they wore the veil, felt that that had an impact upon their mobility around the city centre. Yeah, so there is this kind of coming together, but also it depends on the people and the places that you go.
Right. Please raise your hands if anyone has any questions. There's one in the back.
Yeah. Hi there. When we hear about Brexit in the North East, I think we hear a lot about undertones of race. But do you get a sense that people have more of like a structural conflict? Because you also you often hear about people having kind of an anti-establishment mentality. You definitely draw parallels with the election of Trump there. Do you get a sense that people from Sunderland, that they had like a conflict with their broader structure rather than just the race that presented itself within its within their locality?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say most certainly, because what you've got is, you know, a northeast periphery, which is, you know, very removed both geographically and politically from London and the power base. The power base is there. So, as I said, this has been, you know, this is Labour territory and always has been. And there was, you know, when, you know, so-called New Labour came in, there was also a sense of disappointment with that Blairite kind of form of neoliberalism that, you know, wasn't the kind of socialism that I think a lot of people there thought it might be. So Corbyn has had a lot of support. So you've got here an older form of politicking that's gone on. So there's certainly a case that, you know, with the Tories, et cetera, there, that that has very little connection to what happens in the North East. So given that they've been voting Labour continually, and, you know, it seems like for decades, but have been, you know, kind of, you know, that hasn't affected anything. You know, that has led to this sense of, I suppose, feeling dispossessed. So the actual votes are going down, so less people are actually voting now. So where they do, they might be voting Labour, but there's less of them doing so. So those big power structures are actually integral to the types of feelings and activity, political activity that goes on there.
Has that been expressed to you on the street?
I suppose it was being expressed with the rise of a lot of the splinter far-right parties, some of which were getting quite a lot of support, but not enough to overturn, you know, dominant politics. But nevertheless, you know, what you were seeing was kind of a lot of support for Corbyn and a lot of support for splinter groups, less support for, you know, other left-wing alliances and so on. So quite a complex picture.
Why do you think that that sense of dispossession so frequently does become racialized and so frequently does get expressed in support for far-right groups, and as opposed to any number of other political expressions we could imagine for that sense?
Yeah, that is something that I think we're still puzzling over, really. Why should race become the kind of default position? You know, and you could ask that nationally, you know, and like I said, it may be that there is something psychosocial about this. You know, Gilroy's speaking about post-colonial melancholia, you know, the kind of Britain's status on the world stage no longer being like it once was. And somehow this sense, I think, of, you know, a tarnished whiteness, an identity that was once all-powerful or seemingly all-powerful, you know, no longer having that purchase locally, nationally, or transnationally. So I don't know whether that has some effect, but it certainly came out from our research that whiteness was a kind of core issue for how people were, you know, thinking about things, and that kind of psychoanalytic dimension, psychosocial being kind of part of that.
Did you speak about Brexit directly with people?
We did with the young people. A lot of them quickly wanted to move on from that. They felt it wasn't relevant to them and were very quick to pass over it. So, you know, and a lot said, we're not interested in politics, and then actually said things that were deeply political.
Yeah.
You know, so that happened time and again. So we realised that often the best way was not to go in with these hard questions, but let them sort of sit there and talk about ideas of belonging, for example. That was a kind of nice way of getting young people to open up around some of these issues.
Yeah.
Sort of very much attached to the post-industrial landscape, but I wondered if you could talk more about the world of work and the structure of feelings associated with that, particularly for young people who've probably watched within a family the dissolution of a working class and the shift towards a much looser grouping of precarious workers, and what kind of world of work do they imagine for themselves?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a great question. I've been doing some work, not around race, but around the closure of the steelworks in Teesside in Middlesbrough. And I've been speaking about writing about what I've called post-industrial melancholia. And there, Middlesbrough is also in the northeast region. And certainly I can say from the ethnography in Middlesbrough, there's a very strong association with industry. And particularly heavy engineering there, plant engineering. So even though those jobs are shrinking, you've still got a large number of people wanting to take up engineering apprenticeships, right? And that being seen as a good thing to do. And often fathers and grandfathers, very male orientated, you know, through their connections, getting them places on apprenticeships. And getting one of these apprenticeships is really, really hard to get. You now have to have... you know, it's not separate to education. You actually have to have good GCSEs and often A-levels as well to get into one of the very good apprenticeship places. And so this kind of notion of, you know, a world of work and working with your hands has cropped up time and again amongst the young people, at least in Middlesbrough, that I've spoken with. And they're very proud of that heritage. The alternative there, and it's really heavy public sector work, which is precarious, often in the health service, that actually it's dirty work. And there was also a sense for young men that it wasn't really men's work. So a combination of that has meant that it's not seen as attractive. And, you know, and alongside that is a kind of, you know, what's been spoken about as a kind of bloated unemployment in those northeast areas. And that, I think, is somewhat of a myth in that we encountered lots of people. It was, I think, the precarious labour was much more common. People actually working a number of jobs, temporary jobs, 0 hours contracts, and then getting laid off and then having to sign up to, for unemployment benefit. And that kind of cycle was much more common. So the, you know, so the idea of people not working was far less common. It was actually that kind of uneven trajectory of work.
We had two hands here.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize two things that happened over the last 2 years. And one of them was the Brexit. Yeah, I'm from Tower Hamlets. I'm from Brick Lane itself, yeah. And I was asked to there was a group of us that was asked to see how the voting was going to go, how the in the Bangladesh community, and it was quite surprising how many people actually supported Brexit. And in my personal case, you know, the arguments that I kept on having was with the language that was being used. You know, the language that was being used was, there's too many of them over here, you know. One person actually gave me a running commentary about why we have to vote Brexit, why if you're Asian, you have to vote Brexit. And then he didn't have enough because he came back the next day to my workplace and said, I want to finish, you know, and I haven't finished. I need to finish what I'm trying to say, you know. And it was the language that there's too many of them, it was meaning Eastern Europeans, you know. And so a group of us were trying to say this is the exact language that was being used 30, 40 years ago against us, you know, against the Asians, you know. But now we're using it, you know. And the second thing, the second thing I want to say was in the election, I mean, you were saying that the Alta Valley murder happened on the eve of the election, and they, by strange coincidence, this year, the Alta Valley, the anniversary fell on the day after the election, local election. And it was a weird kind of election because for the last, I'm one of those who collect all the information about who's standing and everything, you know. And in Tower Hamlets, it was a weird situation after 40 years after the Alta Valley situation was that we had the Labour Party and then we had two parties that were based on religion and race, you know, and that they got 25% of the votes, you know. And the election, if you look at the election leaflets, it was based on religion and it was based on race, as in us, you know. And it was a strange situation that there was not one single white working class or black working class candidate allowed, but they didn't, the Labour Party didn't have any working class traditional voters standing. Same with the Conservatives. I mean, I picked up on the Liberals. I said to the Liberal meeting, I said, why haven't you got any white or black candidates standing local? And the candidates who were white or who were black were sort of like the newcomers who've come in. So it's a strange cycle that's happening, you know. And
okay, I think I can... Yeah, I can sort of pick up on what you're saying there. So, I mean, I think there's a couple of points I'd make. One is that it's really interesting in these events how, if you like, when people talk about the working class, they don't mean minorities. That somehow implicitly becomes the white working class. But, of course, you know, working class people, including minorities, voted to leave. I mean, one of the things that I found in across the Northeast, I've done lots of ethnography in Newcastle, was that was already present, these antagonisms towards newcomers amongst a lot of the established Asian communities in the Northeast. So that was already going on. And it's not surprising because asylum seekers and refugees were being moved into those very places in which they lived. So this was much about class rather than race. So they, you know, this was, you know, basically they're moved into places where there's housing that's available housing stock and the cheapest housing stock. So there was a form of churning that was going on in these areas where there was constantly new people coming in and out, and that could be people from in the latest incarnation it was people from Syria, but prior to that it had been people from Pakistan, from Iraq, and so on. So the established South Asian community were the most critical of the so-called newcomers, because they were constantly sort of being subject to having new people on the doorstep, different struggles over services. So these kind of politics were being lived out regularly on the street. So I think that would go some way to perhaps understanding what might appear an apparent contradiction, you know, why, you know, those people might have voted to leave.
My question was about the kind of territorial slogans, you know, that you showed, because it was kind of quite difficult for me to kind of decode what they contained, you know, because you're presenting them in relationship to kind of ideas of belonging and ideas of racialized belonging, and same time kind of overlapping forms of masculine performance and different kind of crews. And so I was just wondering if you could help us decode what, when they say like such and such a thing is best, their crew is best, to what extent does that overlap with these racial territories of Brexit, right, and these other forms of belonging? And I don't know, maybe what's specific in that to Sunderland, do you know what I mean, that we need to understand?
I'm not sure I've got an easy answer to that. I think, if I'm to be honest, I think what interested me was that to young people, these local attachments seem to really matter. You know, they took us to these places. They kept chanting these things out. And for them, that very highly localized form of belonging seemed to mean something to them. quite what it meant around race or Brexit. I wouldn't want to speculate. But it did link up to a very strong pride in place that could then lead to forms of conflict when it became parochial. So there was fine lines, I think, between sort of having that pride in place and it then becoming something about outsiders. So I suppose from our perspective, what we were interested in is the way in which particular symbolic and real boundaries were being drawn out. And graffiti was one of the ways of that in which those places were being marked. And then, you know, places could be remarked, as we saw through the Justice for Chelsea, in very different ways. So I think we felt that this was kind of going to what I said at the start, you know, Les Back's idea of listening with the eye, you know, and that's what we were trying to record and try to do. And, you know, but maybe I'm hesitant to actually put too much interpretive value to it because these matter to them, but I'm not fully sure, you know, I wouldn't want to say with great authority what this actually means, if that's, you know, maybe that contingency is actually needed, you know, around this, you know, because I think, as you said, you know, these things go on in lots of other places, you know, but there's certain moments when clearly things do become racialised, as we saw with the Justice for Chelsea, and that graffiti took on a very different meaning to me in those neighbourhoods when it suddenly became about, you know, well, yeah, a racialised thing that made it very difficult for young Bangladeshis to navigate those spaces, you know.
Wait, sorry, there's a hand in the back. Sorry, we're in the back row.
Hello, my name is Alcina Jeffers, and thank you for your talks. You're here at the LSE. What exactly do you want to happen? Because I listened to you, and there's a couple of things that needs to a bit of clarification. One, you need to look at the government plan of national full employment, and perhaps a place like Sunderland would be a good place to start, where everyone in the area have a job or get a job. And it could be even that a simple job is of them to say exactly what they want to happen without being afraid that people call them prejudice or racial. But people need to speak, because if people don't talk up, you won't know what they're thinking. And if you don't know what they're thinking, when Brexit comes, they'll be more, I might say, just angrier because they haven't spoke about it before. Now, so between now and next 3, 4, 5, 6 months, something needs to be happening. People talk to each other and say exactly what they want. Thanks.
I mean, I'd agree with you, and that's, I mean, we've just put in a ESRC grant, which is precisely to do that. So it's to kind of continue our work in Sunderland, but also go to Peterborough and to Stoke, places that had, you know, real strong tendencies to leave. But we want to know what's happening in these places. So that really, so you're absolutely right. We need to be speaking to these people. And I think, you know, I don't want to be too harsh, but I think some academics, including, you know, probably including myself, have probably done a lot of work in multi-ethnic places where there's very little problems. And, you know, it's precisely these places where we need to hear from the people. So that kind of mapping exercise is something that I'm very committed to actually doing, to actually bring these people centre stage, because these are the people that have, you know, for a long time have been silenced, and we shouldn't make any assumptions about what that, you know, vote might mean, or what, or their understandings about race and ethnicity, because, you know, I've learnt from Sunderland that there can be some very rich forms of conviviality that sit alongside these attitudes to migrants. So I think that is precisely the type of work that I'm, you know, if you're asking me what I wanted to achieve today, is to try and develop an agenda around that.
Hi, yeah. I just want to ask, I suppose, I totally sympathise with the fact that you don't want to speak with any authority for the reasons for these racial issues rising to the surface in Sunderland and potentially elsewhere as well that you're hopefully going to go study. But in your personal opinion, what is the cause of these things? And maybe say, is is it an economic thing? So 20 years ago, great moderation, everyone's got a job, there's no tension there. Do you think these things would have had the potential to rise to the surface again? And if not, is there a failure anywhere else, or is it purely economic and the fact that young people feel like they can't get these jobs, the jobs aren't there, there's the, you know, no rise in real wages as their parents would expect, and the kind of the thing that's been sold to them? So is that what it seems like, in your personal opinion, the reason for these things boiling to the surface again? Because I'm a teacher and taught in a white working class area of Birmingham before coming to London now, and it's really interesting to hear that the multiculturalism exists in schools in the ways that people have multicultural friendships, and they're really strong. But, and listening to the quote from those young people at the end referring to the particular area with the racial slur made me think, the fact that they knew it was racist, I'm not saying that they're not racist because it is objectively racist to use that language, but the education system is perhaps done them well to say that they knew what they were doing was racist, and in wider society is not acceptable to use that, only in a small group. Like, yeah, I don't. Do you think this economic failure? And
I think economics is critical to it. You know, if you look at the voting patterns for Leave, it's critical to it. And there's been, you know, some debates slightly patronising, but have focused on education, so that is a factor. But I don't like the term left behind places, which seems to be used in policy now quite widely, because I think it implies something about those places that's, you know, they're somehow not, you know, it's that old colonial thing that somehow they need modernising, brought up into the present, etc. But I think the economic relations are absolutely fundamental to that project. I should say that we actually had some folk, you know, immediately after those young unemployed men, we spoke to another group of young people that were also working class, not unemployed, and they had lots of very positive stories as well, which didn't really get time to show here. But, you know, so there were some very good stories and people talking actually saying things like, oh, well, race doesn't really matter to us, and that whether it did in practice or not, I don't know, but that was certainly said. So it was a more kind of, complex tapestry, really, that maybe might have come out here. But I think the economic relations are critical, in a sense, to, you know, people just feeling dispossessed, disenfranchised, and constantly not listened to. So Brexit, you know, the EU referendum becomes one way of getting heard, you know, and shouting very loudly about, you know. So, it's felt to me it was certainly in places like Sunderland, it was a lightning rod for a lot of other things that people felt were wrong.
Like, not just not listened to, but actively lied to in terms of like rationale for austerity and things like that. Cool. Thanks a lot.
I mean, it should be said as well that there were plenty of middle class Leave voters as well. And I think that the sort of narrative that you frequently find, the sort of, I don't know, pins sort of the Brexit problem on the working class is very elitist in many ways as well. But there are a few more hands. Should we sort of collect the remaining questions and let you respond, just so everyone can have a chance to ask? So I see at least three hands. Sort of the mic.
I just had a question about you had some quotes from Polish people, and where did they sit in this? Do they have a particular area that they live in, or how do they fit in?
Okay, so that's one is probably here. I can write them down. Polish people,
My question is also about education, in the sense that I don't know where I first heard the term, but there's the concept of empire amnesia, where kind of there's this colonial legacy of the kind of, I don't know, the entitlement, the illusion of superiority, but a real lack of knowledge of the history of how we came to be where we are in this country. Do you feel like, because I'm from London, so in my friendship groups growing up, I would say the majority of my peers were from everywhere, and we all kind of had a knowledge of our history, and we would be able to openly discuss that with our white friends. Whereas in a town like Sunderland, do you feel like there's a place, or would there be a benefit to a greater discussion around colonialism, and, you know, could there potentially be a shift from they're coming to take our jobs to they're coming because we raped and pillaged and all that kind of stuff, like to have a wider understanding of all of us as global citizens and products of history.
I think my question is quite similar to the previous comment. When you mentioned like white victimhood and how it's difficult to talk about race explicitly, it kind of reminds me of this book by Reni Eddo-Lodge about why I'm no longer talking to white people about race. So I was wondering what you think is the way forward and whether there is a need to deal with the post-colonial melancholia that Gilroy mentions, and also whether you think there's a scalar dimension to this, so whether the solution would be a local one or if there needs to be a national narrative or a combination of different scales. I mean, yeah, just would be interesting to hear your thoughts on this.
Okay, are there any other questions before Anoop responds? Oh, yeah.
So this might be a difficult question, but then I guess that you're more than prepared for difficult questions, of course. It's in relation to a particular strand of sociology that has really pushed along this narrative of the white working class as being the left behind, right? And many scholars of race see it as very problematic, because, for instance, they kind of equate the EDL and the white working class as more or less the same, and they kind of dismiss the EDL as kind of almost the victims as well. And I think that they kind of lack a race analysis, but they often engage in stereotyping as well of the white working class. And some of these books have won awards, right? You know, so clearly there's a market for it. Clearly they're impressing someone. So I kind of just wanted your view on that in terms of where you see, you know, because it is quite a powerful, not just in sociology, but in criminology as well. This kind of sociology that centralizes methodological whiteness. I mean, secondly, I actually spend a lot of time in the Northeast because my in-laws are from there. So I spend a lot of time in County Durham, where they're from, in a lot of the ex-mining towns. I go to the Durham Miners' Gala every year, you know, which is like the largest left-wing working-class festival in Europe. More than 100,000 people are there every year. And, you know, one of the kind of dominant messages I see is anti-racism. A couple of years ago, the EDL tried to turn up. They were chased out of town. The Durham Miners' Guild often engage in anti-racist, anti-fascist activities, and, you know, all of this actually, it doesn't kind of really fit that white working class narrative that I was talking about, you know, whereas there's this idea that because of neoliberalism now, everyone is a racist in white working class communities, and I think that's a dangerous narrative that is being pushed by some sociologists, and I just wanted your view on that.
Great. So I think there's a lot of issues here on the table.
There's a lot of issues. I'm not sure I can, get through them all, but I'll have a go at a few of them. Okay. So I think the question about Eastern Europeans and Polish folk that was in there. Interesting. Yeah. In some of the accounts, some of the young people said, "Oh, I had a really hard time to begin with," but then they essentially gave assimilation style narratives and said, "You know, learned to fit in, you know, learnt the language, and things became a bit easier." And you know, some of them regarded themselves as sort of Mackems. That was like people from Sunderland. So there was kind of stories both, again, of like some, you know, some hostility, but also acceptance as well. So it was not straightforward. the question about empire. Yeah, it's barely taught or touched upon, and I think you're absolutely right with that. That it needs to be greater awareness around it. I've done quite a lot of work with the local authorities in the Northeast and with teachers groups, sort of talking about history and pointing out, this might actually touch on the last question, talking about the history of anti-racism in communities as well, so Durham Miners Club, but all sorts of things. So when I first came to Newcastle, for example, there was a lot of racist violence around the football ground. The National Front would use that as a recruitment area, and you know, quite a few of us have worked around this, and you know, statements have now come out saying, you know, things like, you know, we're all black and white, sort of Newcastle playing a black and white strip, but kind of use that to kind of, you know, enforce this kind of, you know, very different way of looking of thinking about the communities that might go there. So there's been some really powerful and important stuff that can come through that education. So, I mean, I'm just a small cog in it, but I've done these kind of workshops with sort of around 30 teachers, which have been really instructive because they've actually told me some of the issues as well that they've had. And they're doing a lot of work in class history stuff as well. And so one of the things I pointed to is that you can actually develop that to include notions of race. And so there's all sorts of fascinating histories there. The Northeast doesn't have the same, it's not built on colonialism in the way that other port cities like Liverpool, Bristol, parts of London were. So it's got a very different history. But nevertheless, it does have histories of migration, particularly from Ireland, but also a white migration that's now kind of seen to be English. But the, you know, the Geordie accent itself, its lilting accent, has its roots in Scandinavia. You know, so this was like lots of Norwegian kind of migrants and so on, and you know, different populations moving through. So showing that, those kind of different groups, I think has been really important to at least some of the teachers that I've spoken to, you know, because I think the sense is that we're all white and therefore all English and we're all homogenous, but actually breaking that apart has been critical to it. Do I need to say any more? I don't know. I'm not sure I've answered all the questions, but I've had a go.
Okay, let's leave it there. Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming, and yeah.
Down, I feel like I'm towering above you if I left them. Great, thanks a lot.
Everyone, please join us outside for a reception right in the lobby. So don't see the way you're all right.